Good afternoon. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:49 p.m. Tuesday, May the 4th. We are meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones with courtesy. And those folks participating on Teams, remember to mute yourselves when you're not actively on. We do have a quorum to conduct business with Senator Reinbold, Senator Hughes, Senator Costello, myself, Senator Wilson here present today. This afternoon, we will take public testimony on Senate Bill 124, the medical health facilities and meds, sponsored by Senate Rules on request of the governor. We heard this bill on the 27th, took invited testimony and had the overview. And at this time, we'll take public testimony, and then we will continue to further have questions from the committee answered to the bill presenters here today. We also, for the record, moved the amendment deadline back to Wednesday, the 6th, 5th, tomorrow at noon, to be turned into our office, just due to the technical difficulties we had last Thursday with the power and with the internet outage. And with that, we'll go ahead and open public testimony on Senate Bill 124. The first person we have lined up is Mark Reagan. And for the record, if folks need to plan, let's see, 2 minutes for their testimony, we do have quite a list of folks here to plan for your testimony. That would be wonderful. And following Mark would be Francesca Allegrezza. I'm sorry, Francesca. Go ahead, Mark, if you're on the ready to put yourself on the record, any affiliation, you may begin when ready.
Chairman Wilson and members of the committee, my name is Mark Reagan. I am an attorney with the Disability Law Center of Alaska. Very briefly, the bill before you is meant to make it easier for people in crisis to get short-term mental health treatment. It's a good idea. It's a good bill. We have some relatively moderate suggestions for alternative language that would make it clear that people would have attorneys appointed for them as soon as they got into the system, to make it clear that evaluations for civil commitment at places like API could be done at crisis residential centers, ideas on the problem of people being readmitted very quickly, and ideas on what it means for an evaluation facility to decide not to serve somebody because it's not safe to do so. We would propose that there be language that refers to problems of being at capacity and not having the staffing to accept somebody as a substitute for the idea of safety, which is too general. But with those minor additions that we think need to be made to the bill, we endorse it. It's a good idea. It replaces a system which is out of date and supplements it. And we urge you to revise it somewhat and pass it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that testimony here, Mark. And Mark, for the record, I see a lot of the folks here on the are here for questions in the committee. So if you did have another minute you wanted to go ahead, we'll extend testimony for 3 minutes for folks. There aren't.
Mr. Chairman, I think I could testify for half an hour or so, but rather than do that, I'll simply stop.
All right. Thank you.
Do you have time for a question? Or
No, we are. If you have a clarifying question on a comment, that just to clarify something that a presenter has made, but this is a public testimony, and we don't want to scrutinize our public testifiers with questions. Senator Reinbold, do you have a clarifying question?
Well, basically, I was just going to ask him, was this bill based on a lawsuit that he had with the state?
Yeah.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, this is an idea which is independent of our lawsuit, but it's an idea that will help to solve and settle the problems raised by the lawsuit and that we settled on. So it's an improvement that probably would be before you, no matter what our lawsuit did, but it's an improvement that helps to make it possible for people to get through the process in a cleaner, simpler, and less time-consuming way.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Next on public testimony, we have Francesca, and I'm sorry about mispronouncing your last name, followed by a Major David Hansen.
Hello, my name is Francesca Allegrezza. I do not support the unconstitutional bill SB 124. What will be considered mentally ill, and who has the right to call someone mentally ill without clear evidence? And probable cause is someone's opinion. Does thinking different from an accuser qualify you as being called mentally ill? In today's climate, what could be called mentally ill when you are not committing any crime? So will it be asking for a second medical opinion? Will it be questioning paid science? Will it be questioning a non-FDA-approved vaccine? Will it be who you support politically? Will it be asking legislators to uphold their oath of office to protect inalienable rights? Will it be saying there are only two genders? Will it be life starts at conception? Will it be your religious beliefs? Will it be your support of the First and Second Amendment? Where does this end? Will it end with a second Holocaust? You cannot confine someone on someone's opinion. This is medical and government overreach. This is a precursor to red flag laws and re-education camps. This is not constitutional, and I do not consent. Thank you.
Thank you, Francesca, for your testimony today. Next, we have Major David Hansen, followed by a Kathleen Wedemeyer. Major Hansen, are you with us? Are you maybe on mute?
Yes, I am.
Oh, there you are. Yes, sir. If you can put yourself on the record, any affiliation, and plan about 3 minutes for your testimony.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Chairman Wilson, and to the senators on this committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this important topic. My name is David Hansen. I currently serve as one of the deputy directors of the Alaska State Troopers based at the DPS headquarters building in Anchorage. Regarding Senate Bill 124, the Department of Public Safety supports the plan to allow the admission of individuals experiencing a mental health crisis to a subacute mental health facility. The issue of mental health and law enforcement's response to calls for service dealing with individuals experiencing a mental health crisis is something the Department of Public Safety views as a priority and with the utmost seriousness. Troopers are often required to respond to incidents wherein people are enduring a particularly bad time in their life or struggling through a singular event that causes their world to spiral out of control. It is not uncommon for people in these situations to be experiencing suicidal ideations, manic episodes, delusion, depression, or other state that is significantly distorted or disrupted by the ingestion of drugs or alcohol. It is during these responses that the trooper's investigation sometimes reveals no crime was committed, but that the subject is clearly in need of immediate assistance. This is where the existence of a crisis stabilization center can offer an alternative to an otherwise inappropriate trip to jail, full-scale inpatient medical services, or simply leaving the individual alone to continue suffering. The Alaska Department of Public Safety is currently partnering with the Crisis Now startup efforts and has collaborated with other stakeholders to help establish the Crisis Stabilization Center and Response Model in Alaska. Creating a location that is available 24/7 where troopers can transport individuals in crisis to receive the proper level of mental health services will undoubtedly reduce the amount of time these individuals need to suffer and allow troopers to return to duty and more rapidly re-engage in serving their communities. We share the same zeal for this bill and its potential as expressed last Tuesday in the testimony provided by Anchorage Police Department Acting Chief Ken McCoy. I would be happy to answer any questions if you have some.
All right, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you for your testimony, although I find it concerning. I don't understand exactly what you're referring to in regards to this, but can you describe a patient that would fit this picture of who you think needs to be detained from a trooper that potentially does not have, you know, mental health training? And the second question is, do you think that anybody, any peace officer doing this should have some sort of a certification? Because I think that would be a good sidebar for this bill.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, to answer your second question first, as far as the certification goes, I can say that troopers starting at the academy receiving, we receive training in a number of different courses concerning dealing with people who are having, you know, mental crisis or other people who are, you know, to include those that I had mentioned that are, you know, experiencing intoxication due to drugs or alcohol. It really is sort of difficult to define when a trooper rolls up on scene to immediately be able to diagnose. As a matter of fact, it's impossible for a trooper to diagnose what is happening with an individual when they're on scene. But troopers are there, you know, initially to many times just to identify what a problem might be or to investigate a crime. And when there's a situation where someone is, you know, indicating that they're experiencing suicidal ideations or where it's clear that they haven't committed a crime and there's nothing that this person needs to be, you know, taken into custody for, that there's another level that we would engage in there to see if the person is someone who does need to be protected from themselves, if you will, or to protect themselves from hurting others. And that's where things like this would kick in and would give us another tool in our toolbox, if you will, to not just, you know, leave them alone or to just not arrest them. It gives us an avenue through which we can partner with our stakeholders to find a place that would be appropriate to maybe just give them some temporary aid. That's the second part. Could you succinctly review the first part of that question so I can make sure I answer it for you?
Yes. So basically I wanted you to describe clearly somebody who was experiencing this, like you would not support this for someone just refusing a vaccine or expressing a political opinion in any way. And I also wanted to ask, would you approve the clear and convincing evidence, not just probable cause, which really is an opinion?
Well, through the chair, Senator Reinbold, as far as would we act on someone who is expressing a different political opinion or not taking a vaccine? No, we certainly would not on that criteria in and of itself. There's, you know, the issues that we would experience on these are people who are experiencing a mental health crisis, and again, through the training that the troopers receive and through you know, the collaboration with the other stakeholders that we have, if we find someone who is in a situation where they are going to be a harm to themselves or a harm to others, but they have not committed any sort of criminal offense, we're taking them to jail would be an inappropriate inappropriate place to take them, and you know, DOC wouldn't have any reason to accept them. This is a facility through which we are able to sort of provide them with the services that they may need and hand them off to individuals who are better trained in identifying the services that they would need beyond just having law enforcement arrest them and throw them in jail.
Through the chair.
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
You didn't describe like a situation. You described the purpose and why you're backing the bill. What I ask you to is describe like what Chief McCoy described was somebody wandering in a road that was like drunk. So, you know, or someone, I believe it's something, somebody screaming out of control downtown or something like that. So what I want is you to describe the patient that you feel would fit this, just so we can have a clear definition. And then I also ask, would you go from probable cause up to clear and convincing evidence?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold. So as to describe a situation as a fit, I think that any trooper that would be available to testify and talk about their own individual experiences, I think any one of us have come across situations over the course of our career where, you know, someone, you know, I can think of times in my own career where I was just responded to something that seemed like a relatively benign call, and it ended up someone, like you sort of mentioned, you know, in the driveway, you know, screaming at me about something that was either, you know, not a, a figment of their imagination or nonsensical, where they were clearly having some sort of episode, perhaps a manic episode. Again, I'm not there to diagnose anything, but something where this person, if left alone because they're frightening the neighbors or they're frightening family members inside the house, and they need the, someone to come and resolve a problem or resolve a situation for them, where they haven't committed a crime, but they're perhaps, you know, they're not frightening people to the point where an assault has occurred, but they're acting in such a way as they can't just be left alone, and they need some assistance or some help. Perhaps they need some, you know, medical attention as far as some medication would go. And again, that's getting beyond what we're worried about. Our purpose would be to stabilize the situation and get someone into a facility where they could use help. As far as clear and convincing evidence, I don't know if we're ever in a situation where we have something is clear and convincing to the point where we can say beyond a shadow of a doubt something is 100% true. We typically respond to rapidly evolving and sometimes peaceful situations that can turn violent at the drop of a hat. So a lot of times we're applying the tools that we have and the facilities and services that we have the best we can to deal with situations so that we can keep the public safe. And a lot of times we use what's just the information that we have available to us at the time to say that we use a clear and convincing standard, I think, is a little beyond reasonable in many situations.
All right. Thank you, Major Hansen, for your testimony. We're going to move on to Kathleen Wittemeyer, followed by Ann Ringstad. Kathleen, if you could put yourself on the record, your affiliation that you may represent, and plan 3 minutes for your testimony.
Sure. Thank you very much, Chair Wilson and committee, for hearing my testimony. My name is Kathleen Wiedemeyer, and I am with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. We are a mental health watchdog group, and I'm with the sort of Northwest chapter. We are concerned with things that are occurring in Washington, Alaska, and Montana. And just on a personal note, I lived in Fairbanks for 16 years, so anything Alaska is really dear to my heart. So now I'll go into the testimony. SB 124 represents a rethinking of the psychiatric system for Alaska. We are against any increase of detention for evaluation and any forced treatment provisions of this bill that would affect the constitutional rights of Alaska citizens. No one should be held more than 72 hours without judicial review. Additionally, a psychiatrist who is a medical doctor must be the gatekeeper of detention beyond 24 hours. One of our main issues with this bill is that individuals may be subjected to unjustifiable confinement and the subsequent consequences of being labeled mentally ill. Another thing that should be included is enacting health outcome measurements. This should be a key element of SB 124. When governments and courts are lobbied to strengthen involuntary commitment and community treatment laws and establish systems that promote treatment, they must also consider the lack of accountability that is currently built into the treatment system and the lack of any real information on creating health in the people forced into treatment. We are told about treatment failures, but what about recommended treatment that fails to produce the outcome psychiatry and advocates promoted? There is almost a complete lack of tracking of actual health outcomes in public mental health in favor of tracking system outcomes. Service utilization, engagement in services, demographics, and ethnic information of the person being addressed. The new system envisioned must be accountable to the citizens via the government that sets up and funds the system. Patient health outcome tracking is a must-have item for the legislators. And this must not be allowed to be watered down or arbitrarily ignored because of imaginative closure violations. You can look at the web pages of the advocates for this legislation, Crisis Now, the hospitals, or NAMI, and you will see none or at best very limited information about the toxic nature of psychiatric drugs, the long list of dangerous side effects, which include violence and death, the addictive nature of some of the drugs, the common misuse of many of these drugs, and especially withdrawal from these drugs. We personally advise anyone to look up the side effects of any psychiatric drug before taking it. We do recognize that there must be a system to address individuals who are experiencing emotional crises and represent harm to themselves or others, and the legislature must work out this system to safeguard the public. As currently written, we see the following issues with SB 124.
And Kathleen?
It lacks accountability and oversight. Two, it lacks health outcomes. Three, it opens the door wide to system expansion. Four, it does not emphasize the overall health of the individual. Five, opens the door to increased involuntary commitment of adults and youth, raising concerns about parental oversight of their minor children. A real focus on a system that will create health and identify physical ailments and disorders that mimic psychiatric disorders will be far more beneficial to the citizens of Alaska that this bill will affect the most. I will say in closing that we have a great deal of information that we can discuss or send to anyone who has questions about medical and physical causes of what appears to be psychiatric ills, dangerousness of drugs, et cetera. So thank you very much for allowing me to give testimony today.
Yes. Thank you, Kathleen. We have a question from Senator Hughes.
Yes. Kathleen, you expressed a lot of concerns, but at the same time you heard the officer talk about in a situation where you wouldn't want to take that person to jail, to DOC. They haven't committed a crime, but yet there's a need there, and you laid out some concerns. So I'm wondering, rather than in general principles that you numbered for us, if you could look at the bill itself and provide some language suggestions that might bring about some of those principles that you listed, I'd be interested in looking at them. So if you could look at the bill itself and provide that offline, I'd appreciate it.
And if
I would be very happy to, Senator Hughes. I have actually, in reality, pored over this bill. And one of our biggest concerns is the jump from 72 hours of confinement on the books in law right now in Alaska to 120 hours. It seems arbitrary. It's not mentioned anywhere in the lawsuit. It's just there. So I would be happy to provide any language to possibly modify some of these points.
Yes, and for all testifiers, it would be helpful if you would like to submit your comments in writing so be part of the public record. That can be done to shss@akleg.gov. Again, public comments can be submitted to be included in part of their official record to shss@akleg.gov. Senator Reinbold, clarifying questions or questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also want to echo the comments of Senator Shelley Hughes. If you have specific concerns in regards to the bill, I would like to work with you, especially it sounds like you're a watchdog for mental health and issues, and you have a longstanding history. So I want to point out, you mentioned something about 72, the hours going from 72, I believe, to 144, something like that. Well, anyway, I also wanted to point out in this bill on page 6, it also does not include Saturdays, Sundays, legal holidays, or any time necessary to transport the respondent to treatment facility. So, you know, that's a big concern as well for me in Section 8. So I don't know how to contact you. If you have a phone number, I don't know if you're interested in leaving it with us right now or how you want to get it.
What, ma'am? Hello, wait, hello? Can we? If Senator Reinbold wants to give out her email address, that would be more appropriate than doing that on the public record and for all folks to do. I think that would be a better situation. Senator Reinbold, if you wanted to give your email address.
I'm happy to give her.
That would be a better situation.
Okay. And sen.lora.reinbold, R-E-I-N-B-O-L-D, @akledge.gov. And all of us are the same. You know, it's S-E-N, dot our first name, our last name, @akleg.gov. So with that, thank you for your testimony. It was actually very informative.
Thank you. Next, we're going to Ann Reinstedt, followed by Sarah Kugel. And if you could state your name, affiliation for the record, and plan 3 minutes for your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Health Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to provide this testimony. My name is Ann Ringstad, Executive Director for NAMI Alaska. NAMI Alaska, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, is a statewide umbrella organization for Alaska's four local and regional NAMI affiliates in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and the North Slope. We provide education, support, advocacy, and public awareness so that all individuals affected by mental illness can build better lives. We support efforts by policymakers and behavioral health stakeholders in working towards a coordinated and integrated system of care that supports prevention, intervention, and wellness for the entire family. To that end, the Board of NAMI Alaska supports Senate Bill 124. This legislation is part of the overall continuum of care in behavioral health crisis response services, particularly at the appropriate lower levels of care. This legislation is essential to allow Alaska to more fully implement proven crisis response improvements, including the nationally recognized Crisis Now model, by allowing first responders to bring an individual in crisis to a low or no barrier or no wrong door crisis stabilization center instead of an emergency room. This new approach follows the national guidelines for behavioral health crisis care using best practices endorsed by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Social Services. Their guidelines are science-based, real-world tested best practices in the behavioral health field. We applaud the Mental Health Trust, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, for their thorough analysis and consideration of the best framework suited for Alaska through the Crisis Now model. We look forward to the continuing discussions about the Crisis Now initiative and urge you to expedite this important legislation. Thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you, Ann.
Can I ask a quick question?
We're not going to do a lot of questions for our public testifiers. Our next person, do you have a clarifying question, Senator Reinbold?
Well, I was just going to ask basically if NAMI was involved in any way in drafting this legislation, or if there was any financial benefit in any way to them.
Yeah. And you can answer were you involved in drafting this piece of legislation? No one is given funds, to my understanding, from the department to have a financial gain to be paid to do the legislation.
No.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, that statement is absolutely correct. We receive no state funding. We are supporting what the Alaska Mental Health Trust is doing to bring Crisis Now to reality.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I didn't ever say get paid for writing legislation. I said benefit after the legislation is passed is what it was, Mr. Chairman.
The entire state of Alaska will benefit. That's all going to be an opinion base. And the question would be, did you have any participation in helping the department write this piece of legislation or the organization?
It's okay.
We may have lost you there, and we're going to go on to Sarah Kugel, followed by Shane Christensen. Sarah, if you could put your...
Hi. Yep. Thank you for this opportunity to let me provide public testimony. My name is Sarah Kugel. I work for Alaska Behavior Health. I am located in Fairbanks. What Senate Bill 124 will do is help individuals receive the correct level of care, essentially. It takes the middle path with subacute mental health crises, and hopefully with the correct resources in place, we can avoid high hospitalization rates and other community agencies such as the police and fire department, which are working outside of their scope of practice right now, trying to help this crisis that we have in Alaska. Using the Crisis Now model, we will make sure appropriately trained individuals will step in before a trip to the emergency room is used. So we support SB 124. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. It looks like we may have lost Shane. dropped off. Shane, if you want to call back in, we will go back to you when we see you back online. Next is Roger Branson, followed by Beverly Schoenover.
Thank you. Roger Branson here. I am an advocate for mental health consumers and a long-term resident of Eagle River, Alaska. I raise in favor of Senate Bill 124 with the clarifications as outlined by DLC, and I greatly appreciate the comments of the Alaska State Trooper Major Hanson, as well as the concerns that Kathleen Meyer and lack of data will have going forward. However, I come about my mental health advocacy very honestly. In 1987, Judge Seaborn Buckaloo issued a temporary restraining order restraining the state from involuntarily medicating me with thorazine class drugs. Eventually, that did change state law to resolve. It took a few years. This bill further defines law and provides a healing path for those caught up in the cycle of homelessness, of mental health, behavioral health issues, and corrections. Forced healing is no healing for the folks that I serve. And currently on the streets of Anchorage, as we go into this post-pandemic era, there are hundreds of people who are positioned to greatly benefit from the crisis now model. Senate Bill 124 will enable that model to actually come online in time to serve these people. And there's been a huge effort at the grassroots level to prepare for this to come along. I greatly urge the passage of Senate Bill 124 and just a couple of comments. One, it will enable peer support, allow our people to help each other as they work through into their own individual healings. It'll allow the traumas that have gone undressed in their lives to be addressed and resolved. A mental health crisis situation, though, it is, as Senator Randall points out, hard to really define. But, Warren, you know it when you see it, and I think that's what Trooper Hanson was speaking into. The 120 hours, that is a bit of a concern. It's a side concern of mine because it takes away the weekends and holidays. So on my own personal commitment hearings, I even though it says 72 hours, they were always 120 hours because they took up the weekend. And I greatly appreciate the work you guys do. Please grease Senate Bill 120 up, send it on through. If we need to do much fixing beyond just these things that have been talked about today, we can get it next year. But let's get it in place so that the folks that are on the streets right now can benefit from the Crisis Now model. Appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Next, we have Beverly Schoenover, followed by Christine Robbins.
Good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Beverly Schoenover, Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Board and Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Our citizen-led statewide advisory boards are tasked with evaluating federal and state laws concerning mental health, alcohol, and other substance misuse prevention and treatment services. Over the years, the legislature has supported many policy efforts to help build a continuum of care for our most vulnerable populations. And SB 124 is a key policy needed for our ongoing behavioral health reform efforts. I would like to speak specifically to the provisions in SB 124 that expand existing Title 47 authorities to allow peace officers and mental health professionals to temporarily hold Alaskans who are in a mental health crisis at a subacute mental health facility, including 23-hour crisis stabilization centers. This is an emergency medical intervention for Alaskans whose mental illness is causing them to be a danger to themselves and who are experiencing severe mental, emotional, and physical distress. As the system now stands, there are very few places for these Alaskans to receive the support they need, and often they end up in our hospital emergency rooms or local jails. Crisis stabilization centers will be staffed by medical professionals and peers who have lived experience with mental illness, all of whom will be highly trained to respond to the medical and emotional needs of Alaskans in crisis. We urge the Senate Hess Committee to pass SB 124 and ask for your continued support for ongoing behavioral health reform efforts to help protect vulnerable Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you, Beverly. Next, we have Christine Robbins, followed by Andre McLeod.
Hi, yes. My name is Christine Robbins. I'm calling from Fairbanks. I'm calling to urge you to vote against SB 124 for a few objections. I'm personally concerned what this will do. I don't believe anyone should have the right to impose a medical intervention on you without your consent. And I believe that's against the Constitution as well. So, and another point there would be there's no insurance anywhere in the world that would indemnify the administrator against harm caused to the recipient. So another danger would be the administration of such drugs based on training alone and not actual medical qualifications and certifications. I believe what you should do, perhaps, as the gatekeepers of our safety, and is what is the case in most states, is make public inebriation a crime and a punishable offense to deter it from happening again. So, like in the FNSB, there is no law against public inebriation. And I just found that out within like a year. And it was very shocking to me because I'm like, no wonder there's so many drunks and people on drugs roaming around and why we can't just go walking freely without fear of our safety. Because it's not a crime. And I wonder who did this to us because I know it wasn't, that's not how it started out. We probably started out with a case against inebriation and someone thought it would be a great idea to get that off the book. So if you could put it back on the book, I think that would help out society at large and we would all benefit. Now, as someone who worked in a jail ministry, I am also concerned about, the mental health of the inmates when they do get them because there is no separation from, someone with a severe mental health issue from what you would say someone who's waiting for their next trial case, whether they're guilty or not. And it puts a lot of the ladies in particular who I deal with in fear, often for their lives. So it creates a very dangerous environment. But anyway, those are my two cents. Thank you for hearing me.
All right. Thank you, Christine. Next, we have Andre McLeod, followed by Elisa Gentleman.
Yes. Hello. How are you? First, I want to just say that Senator Reinbold's question that dealt with funding by the trust to NAMI, it was a very good question because the Mental Health Trust has a lot of programs and grants, and NAMI could, in fact, be a beneficiary of such grants. So rather than just dismiss the question offhand by Senator Reinbold, I think a more accurate response would be needed, especially when the whole mental health system up here is driven by the Mental Health Trust and what I call the mental health industry. They're in it for the money. If anybody thinks they're in it for the people, call me. I could tell you stories. So the problem I have with this bill is that true treatment for people who have psychiatric treatment needs is broken in the state. It's non-existent. It's sporadic. And I don't know how much this 115 waiver with Medicaid has really broken it, but programs that once were available are no longer available. And in the past few years anyway, what I've seen is a lowering of standards for people who have acute psychiatric needs during an emergency, and lowering of certifications, so it includes a psychiatrist is no longer needed in order to give authorization to inject anyone with psychotropic drugs. That was Representative Klayman's, raison d'etre for a long time as to how to deal with things. So what I see here is that we have more diminishment of real psychiatric help for people to in fact get better, which is the mission of the whole Alaska Mental Health Trust with their hundreds of millions of dollars. We're not getting there with this bill. We're not getting there with involuntary injections. That's not how people get better, by being constantly, I mean, it's a horrific thing to be involuntarily injected. So you don't get any positive outcome that way. And any Tom, Dick, or Harry, now you've got these physician's assistants and anybody who's licensed by a board that continues to de-standardize medical professionals, they can say you will get an involuntary injection. So I see this as a catch-and-release bill in order to alleviate the demands for services at hospitals, and, of course, the hospital is a very strong lobby, and this is what they want, this is what they're going to get. You can't fight the hospital lobby in the state. So they will get, and they have gotten, less and less psychiatric patients. They're left out on the street with no care, and now we have this crisis now thing, which is a catch and release. They'll catch them, they'll keep them for a certain amount of time, they'll involuntarily inject them, and then they will just put them back out on the street with no real care or treatment in the long term.
Ms. McLeod, if you could wrap up your comments.
Did you say something?
Yes, ma'am. If you could wrap up your comments, your 3 minutes is up.
Oh, yeah. That's what the end is. They're left out on the streets with no real long-term treatment or care. Alaska Behavioral Health doesn't really keep track of what happens to anybody who doesn't really want to have any kind of treatment, you know? It's the programs. Just API is already half full. I think if it would be fully funded, that would be the answer to fix a lot of this. Thank you for your time.
Right, thank you. Next up is Lisa Gentman, followed by Christina Fritzwater. Lisa, if you could put yourself on the record and plan for 3 minutes for your testimony.
Okay. Hi, my name is Lisa Gentman, and through the chair, I want to say I'm strongly against Senate Bill 124. Why? I've been a healthcare provider, a dental hygienist, a middle school teacher, and a mom, and I have learned the very most critical component for good relationships and success is patient consent. Trying to force students to do work or force dental people to floss their teeth, things like that, it just doesn't work. And I personally have an experience with someone that I love and still love. I had to take this person to a mental health facility here locally, and it was the absolute worst experience of my entire life. I don't want to explain what was going on too much, but it appeared that it was people were forcing different things. I'm not sure I want to go into that detail, but it definitely hurt the relationship. It failed. It made them more claustrophobic. I read up on medicine, and it could make the situation worse. And so the success came when this person instead found running and spiritual guidance. So basically what I'm saying is it's absolutely critical, be it on the record, that the success is critical for the patient to, when they're having counseling or anything, to want to be a part of it and to have a consent and not absolutely to give medicines. It's a very, very dangerous bill. And so I'm just going on the record, please, please vote no on this.
All right. Thank you, Lisa. We have Christina Fritzwater, but for the record, we were joined by Senator Begich, who was on the other state business. Christina, you may begin when ready.
Okay. Hi. My name is Christina Fitzwater. I am concerned about this bill, 124, just because through reading it, I wasn't sure if there were necessarily regulations on what constituted what a mentally ill person might be. And I was just reading that, was worried that maybe that could be abused by people, if they think that, I know that there can be violent people with mental illnesses, but I feel like there might need to be more regulations or something on this, in the sense of it might not be somebody that needs to be impounded in that sense into a mental facility like that. And I do think there's an issue with people not having the choice to be drugged like that up to 3 times. I think that that goes against a lot of rights, and I just would be concerned with that power being abused towards people that might just be saying things that are, you know, I don't know if they are acting violently out towards people. If that was the case, then they would, I would be fine with, I would be understanding why they would be, you know, impounded or anything like that. But I would just, I'm concerned that this could be abused to certain points, and I know there's a fine line with all this. But I would urge to vote against it just because there's not enough guidelines to it, I would say, on where the lines are and how far it can go. So those are my concerns, and I just wanted to call and put that in. So thank you for your time.
Not seeing anyone else online. Anyone here in the room in Juneau wish to testify on 124? Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. Just a reminder, folks, if they want to go ahead and submit written testimony or provide additional public comment, they can by email at shss.akleg.gov. We'll take those comments up until the same time, Wednesday at noon tomorrow. I believe next we have Ms. Carpenter, who may have some answers to some of the questions, provide additional information. She's on Teams. Also, for the committee's reference, we also have from the Department of Health and Social Services, we have Deputy Commissioner Al Wall online. Also on Teams, we have Jennifer Monroe Johnson, the Director of Behavioral Health Services. We also have Nancy Mead, the General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and we have Steve Bookman, the Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Law, and we have a couple of folks from the Trust also online, Eric Boyer and Katie Baldwin-Johnson on the Trust, as well as Steve Williams and Travis Welch. So we have a list of experts online to answer some additional questions, but first we're going to let some of the questions and feedback from Ms. Carpenter before we go into committee members. Ms. Carpenter, the floor is yours. If you can place yourself on the record.
Hi, thank you. Can I just do a quick sound check? Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. For the record, my name is Heather Carpenter. I am the healthcare policy advisor for the department. And thank you for allowing us to provide some follow-up comments. So again, we wanted to remind the committee that this bill is about the civil and voluntary commitment process. And although the bulk of individuals who need mental health or behavioral health treatment in Alaska are served through the voluntary treatment system, we still need a robust and improved crisis psychiatric response system for those individuals who are experiencing a mental health crisis, unable to seek the care they need voluntarily. So currently, you may be aware that only options for evaluation or treatment, whether that be for voluntary or involuntary patients, is at hospitals that serve as designated evaluation and treatment centers or the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Those facilities currently are only in the communities of Anchorage, Fairbanks, Matsu, and Juneau. So in terms of how civil and voluntary commitment works, there is a constitutional process by which a person who's suffering from mental illness and who are a threat to themselves or others or are considered gravely disabled, and all of those are in current statute, how those are determined, how those individuals are held for evaluation upon application to the court. Treatment is then offered to those individuals on a voluntary basis or after a hospital files a petition, which is signed by a mental health professional, and a full evidentiary hearing is conducted where that patient is represented by legal counsel. So when we're talking about Senate Bill 124, this is a monumental shift in how we're going to provide care for those individuals in less restrictive environments. So when we think about this and compare this care to physical care, these new lower level facilities that are in Senate Bill 124 are kind of like urgent care. We are also leveraging our 1115 Behavioral Health Medicaid waiver. That waiver allows for referral-based care determined by need. And through this, we're able to offer supports to immediately stabilize individuals through a crisis stabilization center, which is a much less restrictive alternative to traditional voluntary commitment holds. It's also going to provide referral pathways for individuals who need additional behavioral health services, either through admission to a crisis residential center or community care. As you may remember, through our 1115 waiver, we have set up an administrative services organization, which is tracking individuals and their outcomes, as well as referrals to ongoing community care. The 1115 waiver is driving down healthcare costs by enabling a payment for service providers of critical behavioral health supports. And this includes both crisis stabilization and crisis residential centers. So again, this is occurring because we're diverting appropriate individuals from costly hospital and emergency room care to a Medicaid reimbursable crisis response system, which has already been approved by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. And all of these services are delivered by qualified mental health professionals that, again, were licensed by their license boards and have licenses through our department to provide this care. So these professionals are connecting individuals in a behavioral health crisis to the appropriate level of care, and they prevent that behavioral health crisis from escalating. So when we look at the Medicaid 1115 behavioral health waiver, one of our major goals is to have more treatment options, including crisis stabilization centers and crisis residential centers, in all 9 regions of the state served by the waiver. And this will allow individuals to seek crisis psychiatric care much closer to home than they currently can, especially if you're in rural Alaska. If you are out in, say, you know, Dillingham or Kotzebue, and you have a mental health crisis, you're going to have to wait for a plane and a secure transport in order to get into Anchorage or one of those other locations that have a hospital that serve involuntary patients, like I said. It's been a long road, as you've heard some people say, to how we've gotten here. So if you remember back in 2016, with the passage of Senate Bill 74, it included language directing the department to specifically apply for an 1115 behavioral health Medicaid waiver that would improve behavioral health outcomes while containing healthcare costs. So this waiver has allowed the department to target our resources towards individuals who are super utilizers. So those would be Medicaid recipients who are repeatedly receiving care at the acute and most costly end of the behavioral health continuum of care. So through the 1115 waiver, we have established a comprehensive range of effective services and supports that are available based on the level of need of each recipient. And these new options that are created under Senate Bill 124 is going to supplement our current crisis psychiatric system of care with less restrictive options than we currently have for involuntary commitment care. This bill is a win for patients, it's a win for hospitals and emergency rooms, and it's a win for public safety and law enforcement. And this is a win for patients because we are providing less restrictive system of care options for an individual who's suffering from mental illness. This is specifically a win for hospitals and ERs because they have asked us for more resources to free up ER beds for individuals who are being held on an observation hold until a bed is open at a DET or API. And as you've heard our law enforcement share, it's a win for them because it provides police officers with broader options with how to handle an individual in a mental health crisis. Now, on last Tuesday, a really good question was asked about how minors are treated throughout the process proposed in Senate Bill 124 and in the involuntary commitment process in general. We did provide a written follow-up to the committee that clarifies this, but just for the record, we want to just remind the committee and members of the public that minors have the exact same rights as the adults do in the civil commitment statutes, and they even have more rights for court-appointed guardian ad litems and their parents' rights. Any parent of a minor who is on an involuntary commitment hold receives all the same notices that their minor child receives. And the minors and parents each get their own attorneys appointed. And this is important because it ensures that a parent has representation if they disagree with the recommendation that a minor's attorney is making. We have expanded, as a reminder, who can start an involuntary commitment hold to other qualified mental health professionals. Currently, you know, a police officer can do an involuntary hold, and physicians or psychologists can do an emergency involuntary hold. This expansion ensures that access to care happens quickly when an individual needs it the most. As another reminder, we are expanding the definition of a peace officer for those who can do a hold in order to get someone to a crisis stabilization center for treatment. It will then be up to that qualified mental health professional on staff at the crisis stabilization center to determine if the individual requires crisis medication, other care, or even meets the requirement for a future hold. This change, as a reminder, was specifically at the request of Anchorage providers and their community because of their current effort to stand up crisis mobile teams. However, this does not mean that a police officer or other individual may recommend or administer crisis medications or recommend other care, or if that individual even meets the hold for an individual. So one other inaccuracy that we just wanted to clarify for the record is that we heard some concern that police officers are able to involuntarily medicate individuals and provide crisis medication. That is not accurate. The current laws only, and this bill only, allows crisis medication to be prescribed by a physician, an advanced nurse practitioner, or a physician's assistant. So to be clear, at no time can a police officer administer medications to a person in their care or custody. So thank you, Chair Wilson and members, for allowing us to just share those clarifications with the committee.
All right, we have a couple of questions. We have Senator Hughes, then followed by Senator Reinbold.
Yes, and thank you to all that testified, including during the public testimony and your follow-up, Heather. And I do understand that there, as back to the officer's description, that person has not committed a crime. They're nonsensical, having trouble, difficulty communicating, making a decision, and they need help in order to protect themselves from things escalating and perhaps harming themselves or someone else. So I get that. But we also have a situation where this bill is involving attorneys being appointed, the courts, evidentiary hearings, constitutional rights. So one of the things I would like to see is the possibility of this getting a referral to the Judiciary Committee, because when you're talking about involuntary commitment, it is something we have to ensure that it has the sideboards and some defined parameters so that we are making sure individuals are protected. And so I just wanted to get that on the record. And I don't know how other members feel about that. It's a little bit beyond the scope of this committee, but there are some red flags as far as all there seems to be the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee over some matters in this bill. So I'll just leave it at that.
All right. Next, Senator, unless Heather or anyone from the department has any comment on to Senator Hughes' statements? All right, seeing none, Senator Reinbold.
I 100% echo Senator Hughes' comments in regards to the referral to Judiciary. It's exactly what my staff and I were talking about before this meeting. So I definitely believe, especially in sections two, the probable cause, I think it needs to go a higher standard, such as clear and convincing or beyond a reasonable doubt. I think there needs to be higher standards. I also think, and I think Senator Hughes may have referred to this, but on line two, page two, line seven, mental illness, it can't just be an opinion. It needs to be clearly defined. So I know someone brought that up. It might have been Senator Hughes, but I think that's very, very important. Also, on line seven, it says likely to cause serious harm to self or others. I think that needs to be well defined as well. So I wanted to say that, yeah, in regards to there was a post that my staff put up that was wrong, and it did get corrected in regards to a misunderstanding about a peace officer administering. That was clarified. I know now it's a PA, a nurse practitioner, or a physician.
However, it does make me a little concerned that on page 2, on the top, line 1, they're deleting a psychiatrist or physician who is licensed to practice in the state or employed by the federal government or clinical psychologist licensed by the State Board of Psychologist and Psychologist Associate Examiners. That's something that I think needs to be, I don't think that needs to be taken out. That's in brackets. So that's definitely one of. Do you need to clarify something I said,
no,
Senator?
Go ahead and finish, Senator.
Okay, so bottom line is I want to make sure that I understand that portion of the bill, because if we're deleting that out, that's of concern. I'm still studying this bill. It's a pretty complicated, intense bill, and I think a lot of debate will happen when we do amendments in regards to this. But I will tell you, I've got a lot of questions, and I definitely want to hear from. Nancy Mead as well, at whenever it's appropriate. But anyway, thank you.
Let's go to Deputy Commissioner Wall.
Before we do that, can I just clarify one point? Those are not, Mr. Chair, is that okay?
Yeah, let's.
Those are not deletions. They're encapsulated in another list of providers. So the behavioral type providers you mentioned. They're not actually being removed. They're just incorporated in another list that's in statute. So they could be removed there. That was
okay.
What was explained
through the chair. It says they're being deleted there. So we'll talk about this during amendments.
Let's see if Mr. Wall could provide some clarity to that, and then we'll after any follow up, then we'll go to Senator Costello, then Senator Baggage.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to address some of those questions. For the record, my name is Albert Wall. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. I have written down a few notes here because there's been a couple of statements since Ms. Carpenter stepped off her testimony that I'd kind of like to clarify. The first thing I'd like to clarify is that the providers, the type of people that are being added to the peace officer definition are not being added to any definition of who can have someone committed involuntarily. That is the list of people who, types of people who can take people to the Crisis Stabilization Center. Any commitment process or psychiatric evaluative process would be done there by psychiatric or mental health professionals. There was also a question about due process. And it is clearly defined. It is just not clearly defined in this statute. But I do want to have opportunity for Mr. Stephen Bookman from the Attorney General's office to respond to that, because not only does due process have a definition in law, but so does mental illness. It is already defined in law. So I'm going to phone a friend from the phone and ask if Stephen Bookman can speak to both of those.
All right. Mr. Bookman, are you online, and did you hear the request from Deputy Commissioner Wall?
Yes. Hi, this is Stephen Bookman. I'm with the Department of Law. I believe I did hear Deputy Commissioner Wall's statement. Let me go backwards. First of all, mental illness is a statutorily already defined term that the new bill would not change. It's at AS 47.30.91514, which says a mental illness means an organic mental or emotional impairment that has substantial adverse effects on an individual's ability to exercise conscious control of the individual's actions or ability to perceive reality or to reason or understand. Intellectual disability, developmental disability, or both, epilepsy, drug addiction, and alcoholism do not per se constitute mental illness, although persons suffering from these conditions may also be suffering from mental illness. So that's the statutory definition of mental illness. With regards to due process, procedural due process is a flexible idea that depends on the circumstance. It is essentially notice and the opportunity to be heard. We have in the current 30-day commitment laws spelled that out as, there's a petition and there's a There's an evaluation period, and there's a petition, and there's a hearing in front of a judge at which certain things are proved, and the respondent has the right to read the petition ahead of time and have their attorney go over their medical chart and cross-examine and bring any witnesses they want to bring, and the respondent can testify if they want to. I'm not totally I do want to answer this all's question, but I'm not sure how to do that with regard to the bill, if he could possibly clarify.
No, I think that that was the request from Deputy Commissioner Wall, which I think you answered that. We're going to go to Senator Costello, then Senator Begich, then back to Senator Reinbold for Ms. Mead to answer a question. Senator Costello?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is for either the department or for Nancy Mead. It relates to page 2 of the letter provided by the Department of Health and Social Services, and regarding a minor who's in an involuntary hold. So the parent has representation, and also the minor has an attorney. My question has to do with, in an involuntary hold situation, does the parent relinquish their parental rights at all? And how is a disagreement between a parent and the attorney for the child resolved? And I understand that this might actually exist already, but this is in response to some questions that the committee had earlier.
Excuse me, this is Nancy Mead for the record, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. But I would like to confess, Senator, that this question may be better answered by Mr. Bookman, who has experience in these cases on a different level than I do. And so I think I need to defer that answer.
All right. Mr. Bookman, did you hear Senator Costello's question?
Yes, I did. Again, for the record, I'm Stephen Bookman. I'm with the Department of Law and through the chair. Senator, parental rights would not be relinquished or suspended during this process. I have done a few of these hearings. The child will have an attorney, and each parent, if they're reachable, will have their own attorney. And the way that disputes would be resolved would be by the judicial officer. The child's attorney could argue the child should be released, this is not appropriate. One parent could argue, no, the child should stay. The other parent might say, no, the child should be released, and then the judicial officer would make the determination.
Senator?
Thank you. And as another separate question, so the Disability Law Center letter that we received today in the committee mentions several possible items to improve the legislation, and I'm wondering if the committee is interested in having that draft language presented by the Disability Law Center. One has to do with clarifying whether or not a person who is held involuntarily has an attorney appointed to them by the court, and that might be something that Nancy or the previous speaker could actually answer at this time.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, this is Nancy Mead. And it is the case that a person who is being held on an involuntary commitment is appointed an attorney. The public defender defends those people, and the court certainly does the appointing.
Okay. And then another question that I think is interesting that they bring up is what happens procedurally when a person is released from a crisis stabilization center but immediately needs readmission, and I'm not sure that the bill actually contemplates that situation, and perhaps the sponsor of the legislation could answer that. So the administration.
Yeah, so I think that's a question for Deputy Commissioner Wall. We'll lead him off on that first.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you once again for the record. I'm Albert Wall, Deputy Commissioner for the Department. There is a, and I'm trying to find it in my document that I have here, but there is a provision for pre-authorization for readmittance in this bill where there wasn't one time. Hold on 1 second, please. Mr. Chair, I don't have that right in front of me, but if you will give me opportunity, I will provide that to you in writing.
Yeah, that's fine. We can go to Senator Begich's question, and maybe you'll find it here in a moment. Senator Begich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I regret that I have a bill that's up in about 60 seconds. But before I go, I just wanted to ask on the settlement that's been attached to this with Disability Law Center, on page 15 of 18 under Section 3, actions to be completed by DHSS, if indeed all it says is advocate for statutory changes. So what happens if we don't pass this bill to the settlement is what my question is, and I may not actually be able to stay to listen to the answer, but I think we need to have an answer to that question.
Yes. Is that you, Mr. Wall, or Mr. Bookman?
Mr. Chair, this is Al Wall for the record again. My apologies. So I found an answer to the first question, if I may. Readmission for a patient is subject to court order and is part of the admission process in the first place. So admission includes readmission, if necessary, and is subject to court order. And then the question from Senator Begich, if we might rephrase that for me.
Is, and Senator Begich had to step out, but the question, I'll try to rephrase it, is what would happen under the Disability Law Center if we don't take action on this bill? Would we be in violation of the judgment that was passed?
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair, in response to that question, the answer is no, we would not. As even Mark Reagan himself testified to earlier in this hearing, this bill is not tied to that settlement. I would, however, say that a piece of easing the burden on the system of care that addresses the need of the patients in Alaska is this bill. And this bill creates that next level down level of service and care that will support the model that is addressed in that lawsuit. But again, this bill is not tied to that lawsuit.
All right, thank you. And the final question will go to Senator Reinbold. I think you had a question for Ms. Mead, or whatever question you would like to ask.
Well,
this time.
First of all, I want you to understand that I have no problem establishing a new subacute, you know, type treatment center at all. If that bill just did that, I would be completely fine. It's just a whole bunch of other issues in regards to this. But I really appreciated Nancy Mead's question. I was basically going to ask very similar to what Senator Costello, and yes, the answer for you, Senator Costello, is I would like to look at draft language as well from the Disability Law Center. What my question to Ms. Mead is in regards to the involuntary crisis center, and I did call the public defender before this meeting actually as well, and she raised some concerns. But what my I'll let her speak for herself. Not I don't want to speak for her, but bottom line is, will every single person get provided representation for the involuntary confinement, Ms. Mead?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Under the current involuntary commitment statute, the respondent, that is the person who is being involuntarily committed, does receive public or counsel, and if indigent, public counsel, that is, at state expense. And that includes minors, as was previously stated. Under the bill, as I read the bill, the person could be held for 24 hours before being moved to the more residential crisis center. And in that situation, my read of the bill is they would not be appointed an attorney during that time frame. Later, if the person is admitted to the Crisis Stabilization Center, which, as I read the bill, has a time period of up to 5 days, and the person is not voluntarily there, and some will be voluntarily there, I assume, then that person can request a hearing, and I'm reading from page 5, lines 11 through 23 for that situation, and the respondent can be represented by the public defender agency, and the court would appoint them, and I'm looking at lines about 15 through 18. So in that situation, the person would be represented by an attorney.
Through the chair?
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Nancy. This is extremely helpful. I really appreciate it. My next question to you would be in regards to the bill, and I don't know if it's exactly the right time, but in regards to the advanced healthcare directive, I wanted you to weigh in regards to that. It's closer to the more of the end of the bill, and are you familiar with that portion of the bill?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, just a little bit. I assume you're speaking about Section 9.
Correct.
On page 6. As I read Section 9, with respect to the administration of psychotropic medication, these facilities, just as always, there isn't much changed in the first several lines of the statute, can administer that medication only with court approval. There is a longstanding statute about the involuntary administration of psychotropic medication, and that is referenced in page 6, line 22. And that is where the healthcare provider has to petition to the court. There will be a hearing on whether the respondent, the person, has the capacity to give informed consent or not. An attorney is appointed. There is a court visitor appointed who goes and meets with the person and determines some recommendation to the judge as to whether he or she can give informed consent, and then the court can give approval for the involuntary administration of that medication or say that it is not approved. So the new language, however, starting on 22 to 31, as I read it, is that if the patient is capable of giving informed consent and gives it, then the mental health facility can go ahead and give it. I'm not entirely clear on the application of lines basically 28, even if the patient refuses at that time. That would be a question for the sponsor on what is envisioned with that thinking. So I think that's as much as I can say about that provision.
All right. And with that, we are out of time. I don't know if Al Wall, if you're able to provide a written commentary to answer that question. I am seeing a head nod by your representative here in the audience. And also, we have a question. Does API, does that have to go through the Certificate of Need process? Is the another question here from the committee.
Question on the record for next week.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to answer those in writing.
Okay, and
maybe this one on the record.
One question, too, from Senator Hughes.
Yeah, so I'm looking at AS.30.655, and there are six principles for mental health care. The first five kind of make sense, that opportunity to accept, you know, reasonable opportunity to accept voluntary treatment, least restrictive alternative environment, treatment occurs promptly as possible, close to the individual's home, system of community facilities, supports be available, patients be informed of their rights and be informed of and allowed to participate in the treatment program as much as possible. That's all good. But the last one is my concern, and I'd like to know, it's a worrisome, because persons who are mentally ill but not dangerous to others be committed only if there's a reasonable expectation of improving their mental condition. So I'm just wondering if the consent is required to that, because that's not for protecting anyone. So I have just a question about that, if they could, how that would weave in, because we're basically wanting, this would allow involuntary commitment, not for safety purposes.
All right. And with that, we try to get that answer too. That concludes our business today. On Thursday, May 6th, we'll continue this hearing on Senate Bill 124, but before we do that, we'll bring back Senate Bill 38 back before the committee for purposes of CS that I believe is ready. And with that, we are adjourned at 3:08 p.m.